So good evening. And is the recording on? Am I just carrying on? We're all set? Thank you. Welcome. I mean, they all welcomed you, the Sims folks, but I welcome you here too. So it's lovely stuff to share this Dharma stuff, so I'm really happy to be able to with you. So glad you're here, so I can. So tonight, and some of you know this because some of you will have seen some publicity somewhere, I'm talking about, and not just tonight, but this weekend, and some people are here for the weekend. Who, by the way, is going to be here for the weekend practice? Oh, lots of you. I'm so happy. The topic is about calming ourselves, calming and steadying ourselves. So in that last half hour, we just had half an hour of sitting, was there anyone whose attention was really calm and stable and you were able to be present for half an hour, non-stop, anybody? See? We're not so calm in there, are we? Even if we're not really distressed and really freaked out, which some of us are some of the time, even then, the attention isn't stable. It isn't stably present. It's busy zooming around and jumping around and skitting around. And the reason why we want to have stable attention and calm attention is, for example, you know, well, you probably know, but I certainly know, I have communications with numbers of students long distance because I live in a little island far away from anywhere, Shangri-La. And so I communicate by phone. And quite a few people would like to communicate via Skype because phones cost more than Skype. And the trouble with Skype is that Skype is sketchy, you know, and you see the person and then you don't see the person, then you see the person, then you don't. And you hear them and then it drops them, it's called. Or you're breaking up, is what we say. And isn't that frustrating? And the connection and whatever it is you're talking about and exploring together keeps breaking up. And so it's a very bitty kind of unfolding, whatever it is. Well, that's what our attention is like all the time. And what we're attempting here in meditating is, particularly this form of meditation, is to have some understanding of what's going on inside. That's called insight, to see inside. Well, if you can only see inside like a poor Skype connection, you're not going to actually learn a lot. But if you have a stable, good connection with what's going on inside, and your gaze, or whatever you want to use, your attention that can look inside, is able to be sustained and steady, you'll learn a lot. And what you'll learn is how you are inside. You'll also learn not just how you are, but when how you are is helping you, and when how you are is distressing you more. You can't help but see that when you can see inside. But you won't see very much if it's just a glimpse and a glimpse, and then it breaks up, and then another glimpse. It's not enough information. How we are inside is an unfolding behavior that keeps going to this, and then it turns into that, and then it becomes that. But if you just got a bit of this and then a little bit of that later, it's all bitty. And so we need to be able to see inside and get to know and become familiar, intimate with the workings of our inside, our mind and our heart and our psyche and so on. It's only when we can do that that the behaviors and the tendencies which result in more distress can be understood and then chosen not to continue doing. But that is a process that takes being able to see it over and over and over and in a steady way. So that's why we need to calm the attention down. And our attention isn't calm, as we all know and we see all the time, for very good reason. It's not just that we're doing something wrong, you know, or that we're flawed or something. It's that different things. One of the things is that this, the contents of where we're paying our attention, which is all the things that are going on, are extremely unstable. Like there's this happening and that happening and something else and then something else coming in from the other side, and it's very rapid fire bombardment of sensory information happening. And we're trying to catch all kinds of bits of it, and so we're unstable in our attention because we're doing multitasking to the max and often really rapidly. Particularly in the modern era, way more bombardment and way more rapidly than, you know, even one generation back, let alone, you know, five generations back. When the lights were out, when the sun went down, and a little bit of tapestry for an hour and a half, and then, oh, my dear, I must go to bed now. You know, it's not like that. And when the cities weren't so crowded and, you know, and horses clopped around to hurry you up to get to the next place and things like that, you know, it's very different. So that's one thing. Another reason that we have this unstable, unsteady, uncalm inner reality attention is that we believe that we need to notice all these things that are going on, because we believe that we need to make sure we experience a goodly amount of nice things, and that we prevent ourselves from or unhook ourselves from having too much unpleasantness happening. We believe that that is how to make ourselves okay. We believe that the bombarding information coming into our senses is the reason for our state of being. That's a belief. It's actually an error in belief, but it is our belief. So if my circumstances are benign, I'm fine. If my circumstances are, you know, deplorable, I'm really miserable, and so on. So that's what. And so we're placing our attention on these changing pieces of information. So of course our attention is stirred up by that. We spend an inordinate amount of time trying, noticing all the things that are happening and trying to kind of calm them down. Like, oh, no, shh, you know, trying to rearrange things and settle them down. Futile, of course, because life isn't like that. It's endlessly stimulating. I like my silk scarf. I just was given it recently, so I'm not going to take it off. Another thing about our stimulated minds, our overstimulated attention, is that it isn't just that we look at the stimuli for well-being and think that that's what causes it. We get very stimulated by it, and we deliberately focus on the extremes of that. So we focus our attention fully on the highs, and we focus our attention fully on the lows, and we don't focus that much on the in-between kind of more ordinary things. In fact, we completely dismiss them. You know, we miss all kinds of people if they're not particularly attractive or particularly irritating. You know, they're just ordinary people, and why bother with them? You know, they're just a neighbor. I have no idea who they are. Or they're just somebody who works in the back of the shop, you know. We do that with everything. And that stimulates us. We kind of are addicted to stimulation, and so that it causes more agitation internally. And another one is that this is just to reassure us that we're not crazy, is that to survive in the very beginning of being a human being, so that the sociologists and the people who study these things say that it's the jumpy, nervy people who survived, the dinosaurs, really. Because if you were all complacent and laid back and easygoing and calm, you got eaten or, you know, or attacked or something. You weren't ready for trouble, and so you didn't survive. So the genes that survived are the nervous, you know, wired people. So forgive yourself for being agitated on the inside. But we're wanting to help that in order to be able to learn about how to free ourselves from our, I call it neurosis. Those of you who have heard me talk before know I like that word. So, oh yes, furthermore, one more very important reason why we're agitated is that it isn't just that things are always changing. It's that because things are always changing, nothing's reliable. And when nothing's reliable, we're really insecure. And it isn't just that it's not reliable, it's that sometimes it will be lovely, but then that won't last. And sometimes it'll be awful, and we have no idea when that's going to happen. And we're really not, even though we try to control everything, in charge of 99% of what happens. And it ends in death. And we don't know when that will be or how. So, we're agitated. Perfectly reasonable. And the trouble that we have another erroneous belief is that one of the ways the Buddha described this experience of everything is always shifting and changing, like living in quicksand, he called these the eight vicissitudes, and lots of you will know this, but the eight vicissitudes, the changing things that we experience, which make up everybody's life, normal life, are pleasure and pain. These are the extremes, but there's everything in between. Pleasure and pain. Loss and gain, praise and blame, and fame and ill repute, the opposite. Your life is one series of these things. But the error that we have is in believing that that's the way it is. We say, oh no, it's supposed to be four. We'll have the praise, thank you very much, we'll have the pleasure, we'll have the gain, and the fame, and we do not want the other four. There's a problem when they happen. That's a mistaken belief, because they happen. And so to think that there's something wrong is wrong. There isn't anything wrong, it's how it is. But because we don't accept that, we're struggling with every time it changes from good to bad. And every time it changes to good, we're all excited, and we want to get all stimulated with trying to have more of that, and so it's that erroneous view that means that the way we relate to these eight things compounds the stimulus and doesn't actually soothe us. So those are not all, but a goodly number of reasons why we're not calm and we need to be. So to calm ourselves down is what I want to talk about, and the various ways which really help that happen. And for the weekend, what I'm offering is that we practice with some of these things which calm us down, so that they calm us down. Because these are good words, you know, it'll sound useful, and it's not exactly news, you'll know, because we all know these things. But the value of the Dharma isn't in the words and isn't in the ideas, even isn't in the clarity or the power of them, is in actually experiencing them. And so we have to practice that. So knowing it isn't enough. Especially knowing it with your intellect is absolutely not enough. We have to know it deeply by experiencing. Everything the Buddha taught was about experience, wasn't about thinking and knowing. If that were enough, we'd all be saints already, you know, because we know better. We know not to be angry and not to be frustrated and not to be mean to ourselves. But it didn't stop us, did it? Okay, so we can become calmer. We can do it differently, but it takes practice. So a book I've been reading recently, and we were talking about it today, and I've been talking about it quite a bit because I'm very impressed by this book. Oh, Linda, you'll happily hear this. It's one of the most rich books I've read in years. It's not a Buddhist book, but it's a book about the right and left hemispheres of the brain, the master and his emissary. Has anybody heard of this book? I know Linda has. Anybody familiar with this book? Not very, just a couple of you. The subject matter is intriguing, and particularly, you know, I find it intriguing because I'm interested in the mind and how the mind works and what happens as we meditate. And it's a book that's researched hugely, thoroughly, and draws on a whole last 2,000 years of Western civilization and its evolution in terms of the right and the left functionings of our hemispheres. And it seems to me that in large part what we do when we meditate is we attempt to withdraw the preoccupation we have with the activity of the left hemisphere, which is commenting, describing, evaluating, comparing, figuring out, etc. And instead rest our attention in this book's terms, the master, the right, the whole, which is healthy and holistic, you know, that word whole and heal all come from the same word, same root. Big awareness that doesn't differentiate, that doesn't have to fix or take apart, but can actually, it's more direct, intuitive, it's quiet. Who here has not heard of My Stroke of Insight by Jill Bolte Taylor? Who's not heard of that? A few of you, not very many of you. Google TED Talks, Stroke of Insight. It's another extraordinary, it's about the same thing, left and right hemisphere. It's a neuroanatomist woman at 37, at the peak of her career at 37, which is altogether brilliant, and a female, what's more, who had a stroke in her left hemisphere, but who knew what was happening because her right hemisphere was functioning beautifully, except that she couldn't speak or explain it or communicate, but she was completely functional just in the right hemisphere, and she writes about it. She does a TED Talk about it. The book's not very long, and it's very inspiring, and the TED Talk's brief. It's 18 minutes or 16 minutes, and there she is describing what it was like for her. She's so brilliant. She is no Buddhist either. She doesn't ever use the word Buddha, but she really lives for a long time. She's gradually healed her left hemisphere with a lot of help from her mother and a lot of patience. But she lived being just a right hemisphere functioning person, which she calls nirvana, and describes the joy of being so expanded and being so connected and being so merged and being so open and not having this crazy left hemisphere, and describing and commenting and worrying and planning. And she doesn't actually want it back, but she would like to talk, you know. But she's worried that if she gets it back, will she lose her happiness, you know, her big, profound freedom from worry and planning and everything? Of course, she doesn't get a career back and all of that piece. But anyway, it's very revealing because she knows the brain. She's a neuroanatomist. She's a brain scientist. And so to have it described in her language is very extraordinary. It's very, for meditators, it's a fascinating read, or even just the talk is fascinating to get, because you see how what all spiritual practice is attempting to do is get us in touch with the bigger part of ourselves, this quieter, more holistic, more directly connected, interconnected wisdom, rather than the individuating little part that's always trying to figure everything out, and utilitarian part of ourselves that's always exploiting and scheming and worrying and manipulating, that part. And I just find it so relevant when seen in that language to what it is we're doing and what it is we develop. We develop increasing access pathways to this more silent, expanded part of who we are, more naturally who we are. So, to help this happen, there are things we can do. These things we can do in practice, we discover that actually we will be doing more of naturally the more we meditate, because by seeing inside how you're functioning, you'll see when some of these things are happening, you'll be feeling calmer and better, and when they're not, you won't. You'll already, you know, it's like it's the natural fruit, we use that phrase, of meditating is more calm. And with it, the various things which help the calm. So it's not a cart before a horse exactly. It's like either can lead to the same direction. It's like whether the chicken came first or the egg came first. The fruit of practice and the practice of practice are sort of both going along together. So many of you who've practiced a lot will have a lot of these already, a lot of access to a lot of these things, but we can still keep deepening these sort of supportive ways of using the mind. So we're using the mind to help the mind. We're using the wise part of the mind, i.e. some of the right hemisphere parts of our minds, to help with calming down this very agitated left hemisphere that's always trying to make us watch out for dinosaurs and things like that. It's been doing so long, you know. So, We are, one of the things when we're agitated and not calm is that we're like a lion that's hungry. We're hungry. We're not okay. We're agitated. We're in a state that's, oh, I'm worried about something. Oh, I've got to deal with this. It's too much work. Da, 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 da. This isn't okay. This moment and this experience I'm having, oh, it just is not it. I've got to do this. I've got to get this together. I've got to get rid of that. I've got to sort this out. That state of being deeply not satisfied. Another word for that state is hungry. We're hungry for something else. We want to be rid of this, we want to be over this, we want to have done this, we want to have more of this, we want it to be some other way. And that state is a state of being dissatisfied. We know it all really well. So when we're in that state, when we're just not satisfied with what's right here, we've got to do something and more, that state needs to be shifted. Well, how do you shift hunger? You feed it. When you take the lion who's hungry, it's prowling around, it's on the hunt, you know, it's on the make, it's busy, busy. Well, when it's had a feast, if anybody's, I've never been to Africa, but when you've seen, I have Northern Africa, but I didn't see lions. When you've seen on TV a lion that's had a feast, it doesn't go anywhere for about 5 days. You know, it's really content. It's like just lounging around, satisfied. So how do we satisfy this hungriness? This, you know, oh, not quite enough, not quite yet. You just got to wait till this is sorted out, and then that's sorted out, and then the mortgage is paid off, and then the kids are out of the house, and then and we get that new job, and we get rid of that coworker, and oh, you know, all of that stuff. We find that Prince Charming, that Cinderella dream, then it'll all be fine. So how do we satisfy ourselves? Well, the simplest thing, it's the simplest thing, is instead of looking at what's not okay, is we look at what is okay. It's so simple. And so we just deliberately choose to place our attention, which we can do. We actually have got a lot more power over our minds than we realize. When we don't exercise that authority, the mind thinks things and worries things and tells us things and we believe it. And we're run crazy by it. But we can actually behave like we're in charge of it. And we can say, actually, I'm not going to think that, I'm going to think this. And then you can think, what is it that you have in your life that you are nourished by? What feeds you? And there are a million things that we all have that are so satisfying to even just think about for a minute. All kinds of things. I mean, I'm just going to list half a dozen, but one of my favorites is plumbing. I think it's fabulous compared to what it would be like to not have that, you know. And you know, things like the modern era provides, like garbage disposal and street sweepers. I think that's really, really reassuring for me. I get really agitated when that's not the case. That's just my particular thing. What else nourishes me? Springtime, majorly. Look at the beauty around, you know. People. There are certain things that inspire us, certain people. Beauty. Paintings. I saw a thing fairly recently at the IMAX Theatre in Victoria on Van Gogh. And it's so great in a big theatre like that with its that IMAX, that kind of way of, because it would zoom like so close in you could almost eat the paint, you know, and then the incredible, anyway. Eyes. Ears, hearing aids, incredible, to help those ears, which are incredible, music. There's so many things we all have, people in our lives, we're born with gifts, we've developed skills, we've been given who knows what, we live in a temperate climate. I know the politics here, let's not get into right now, because it's but you know, There are systems, you dial 911 and things happen, you know, there is a reasonable amount of good organization holding us up. There's an awful lot. We have good consciences. We've learned some of our lessons well. Anyway, to count blessings is unbelievably nourishing. And if you just count some blessings, at whatever speed, however many, slowly, just savor one or two. Realistically, it's soothing. The experience changes inside from one of agitation to one of a little more satisfaction, and that's calming. It's very simple, and it's not just theory. It's a good idea. It sounds nice. Count your blessings. Be grateful for things. But when we really live that way, we're way, way more contented. You know, it's obvious. And then the whole wiring starts to change. The blood pressure goes down. You know, you get ulcers if you don't do that kind of thing over the years. So that's one. I have seven such things to remind us about. So that's the first one. Chocolate. If we were more contented, the whole, you know, consumer culture would collapse, unfortunately. It's based on, and, you know, I was just traveling, and which I do a fair bit, but something or other that I was reading, I was realizing the language of the thing that I was reading, promotional, like, you know, advertising stuff, right? And it was encouraging you to get a spring getaway. And just the language of, like, get away from it all. As though going away from it all will actually satisfy us in some way that being here won't satisfy us. It's just a whole way of perceiving that's so erroneous. Anyway, we can be far more satisfied with what's already here than not having to go and get more stuff, you know, or another experience. And the more we meditate, the more we realize that, the less, you know, we need anything other than what is here. So it's beautiful. We become more grateful and more simple. That's the first one. The second one is this agitation, is the sense of insecurity that I mentioned. We can't really settle with quicksand, you know. It's like, where do you become steady when anything that you turn to is going to disappear on you? You know, even people, even loyal people, change, you know, or something can happen and then somebody breaks their word or gets sick or falls in love with somebody else or all kinds of things that we think are reasonable, health, for instance, are not reliable. And so how to live, it's not just hunger, but it's the deep sense of insecurity. That's a major cause also for this agitation, of course. And so where do we turn, honestly and truly, without kidding ourselves, for security, when we can really see clearly how everything is changing? It's quite a question. And it's no coincidence that at the beginning of, two lists that I can think of in the teachings of the Buddha, the five spiritual faculties, Indriya, those of you who are interested in the teachings of the Buddha are familiar with it, with the various sophisticated and specific ways the Buddha taught. The first of those five, the faculties which, you know, lead us onwards in our spiritual life, is faith. The first in the 12 links of transcendent co-arising, those of you who know about that, is faith. Faith, the word faith, I'm not really, it's got way too many connotations of religion. But what it really, the word I prefer to use for that is a sense of trusting. When we're trusting someone or something, we can give ourselves over to that a little. A great example I have is, I remember when I was getting into a relationship quite a number of years ago now, and I was not sure. And those of you who know me at all know that I always say this. The way my mind is wired is that whenever I'm thinking about anything, I have visual imagery associated with this. I have lots and lots of images, and so it's just the way it is inside my head. So in this relationship, I was like, sort of checking it out, and I was doing a lot of x-ray questions, you know. Well, what do you believe in this? Because I felt like I was going to get into this boat, this little canoe, and was it going to be full of holes, and was I going to sink? Or was it actually going to hold my heart for some time? Was this a reliable thing? Could I trust this as a possible relationship. But the image was stepping into a boat and it not sinking, you know, like, could I give my whole heart to this? Well, when we can do that, it's trusting. And when we can't, it's like, doubting. The opposite is doubt. Doubt is one of the, those of you who, again, are interested in the teachings or are familiar with the teachings of the Buddha, in the way he described these different ways of understanding ourselves, is the biggest of the hindrances. It's the most sort of underlying of all of the hindrances, a sense of doubting. I don't really think this is okay. I'm not quite sure if I can do this. I don't know if I should continue any further or what's going to happen. I don't know. It's that kind of like worried, agitated kind of like hesitancy, doubting. So that's not trusting. And so it's also no coincidence that people who have committed themselves to Buddhist practices traditionally over the thousands of years, first thing they do in practicing and in the beginning of their day, I did spend a few weeks in Burma with Sayadaw Tejaniya, 3 o'clock in the morning, coming across the radio for like 5 mile radius, there's this weird sound, and after a while you realize it's a Burmese accent of Pali chanting the refuges. The refuges, I take refuge, I place my heart upon these three, the triple gem, for those of you familiar, you don't have to be familiar with this, but it's like, it's no coincidence that right in the beginning of doing some meditation practice, we remember what it is about it that we trust, so that we have a little calmness, instead of this feeling like, I don't know if this is actually going to do anything, or if it's going to be worthwhile, but I'll give it a go. That doesn't actually help with being able to really practice, with being actually able to be present and calm enough to keep looking and see what's going on. So we need to find, what do you trust? And it doesn't have to be a religious thing. It doesn't have to be a, you know, in a spiritual domain. But what do you trust? Is it a person you trust? Is there someone whose opinion you trust? Or, one of the things I do for trusting, because people weren't my first choice for trusting, to tell you the truth, from my childhood. It wasn't where I would go for trusting. But where I would go for trusting is nature. I'm a live-in-the-country person. I always have all my life lived in the country. And I have a large garden, and I love not just the wilderness, which strikes me as a little bit too wild and chaotic, but a little more civil. I'm English, right? So gardens is perfect for me. The spring in the gardens, you know, and here they come, pooping up through the ground, all these little green things, they're doing it again, right on time. It's just as it should be. Everything is, all's right with the world, the daffodils are out. You know, it's hellebore season and they're doing it right on time. So reassuring. For instance, that's just an example. But we all have the examples that we know, which is where we can go. Put it where, when I say go, we put our attention there, that is like reassuring. Yeah. Honesty is one of such thing. Honesty is one of the most reliable things in the world. When we can get it out and say what it is, and we really know what it is, we know what that feeling is like, we know we can trust it. And of course, lying has the opposite effect, right? We're just all on edge and we aren't sure. And we know that. So we'll practice some of this tomorrow. And some of the things which will evoke, invite, contemplate, and then observe the calmness that comes as we do this kind of thing. One of the things I like about, it's interesting in doing, preparing for this and thinking about what are some of those things. One of the things that we all humans trust is the earth being solid. And one of the weirdest things that happens to people who live in earthquake, have had an earthquake, is having to live with the fact that that's not actually reliable. Now, I know there are people who live in countries where there's always lots of tremors, like Japan, for instance. I've never been there. You know, and that's a, you know, part of the world which you experience apparently a lot of that, but it's really rare here. There are tremors going on all the time, but they don't upset us the same way. But if you live in a place where it's not such a common occurrence, it's a very unsettling situation, because that solidness is one of the most solid things we know. And we're on it, and when we fall over, it catches us, and you can't get away from it, and you can't fly off. You know, you can run fast and jump high, but only so fast and only so high. And then when you're tired, the earth wins again, you know. Strong. And so trustworthy. Solidity is trustworthy, and you can even feel this in your own body. And I know it's an odd way to do it, but this is part of the way that I've explored my own way of what is it that I know I can rely on. I can really rely on my thigh bones to take the weight of my trunk. It's unbelievable. But they absolutely, they're pillars, and they do it. Bones are reliable, unless they break, which is sometimes, but not very often. And there's this great big solid pelvic basin which holds all your innards up. You don't fall out. You don't. It just holds you there. It's incredible. Solid, reliable, good, works. It's as simple as that. But that feeling makes you smile. I mean, I'm not kidding. We have a pelvis. It holds up the soft stuff. That's how it's designed. And you know that. That feeling isn't agitated. That's a feeling of like, yep. Yep, legs are there, for instance. So using what in whatever way you can find to shift your attention to what is trustworthy, and how can you feel that feeling that changes, and then you'll realize the calm is much more settled. Simple. And we can do this a lot. You can practice like this, and we can keep observing the change going on inside your system. This reminds me of that TED talk again, which I know, well, 31 million people have viewed it, so I wouldn't be surprised if a bunch of you in here have viewed it. Amy Cuddy and the brain and the body affecting the brain. Have anybody seen that one? So I'm amazed. She's an anthropologist and studies the brain. It's a great TED talk. Amy Cuddy, C-U-D-D-Y. Something like, it's got power and brain and body in it. And what it is, it's an extraordinary thing. It's not surprising in a way, but it's completely like, you know, it's all scientifically measured and everything. I'll try to be brief. When you're in a company with somebody who's feeling really confident and really powerful, they manifest kind of power just by the way they stand or they sit or they kind of like spread themselves out or talk really loudly and throw their arms around like that. And if you're with somebody who's feeling really insecure, they do the opposite. They kind of shrink and collapse and like, oh, I don't really know. I don't really know. Right. And you feel it, and you can feel energetically how they are. Well, she said, she decided to ask, I wonder if we know it affects other people, but I wonder if it affects the person who's doing it. And so what she did is measure people, and she measured their hormones. She just thought that was the most interesting part. And so she measured two hormones. One is the stress hormone, cortisol, and one is the power hormone, testosterone. And so what she did was she had people pose for 2 minutes in a power pose, and then measure their, you know what I'm talking about now, measure their testosterone level and their cortisol level before and then after the 2 minute pose, and then and the opposite, a collapsed pose. And these are people, you know, it was blind, double blind studies and stuff people didn't know, and then people assessing, videoed and assessing them, who would you hire? And a lot of the time she used it for people, she educates people who find themselves in stressful situations and they want to overcome the stress and be confident. And a typical example she used was people going for a job interview. And typically when you're waiting your turn for the job interview, you're like, like that. And she said, all you have to do is stand there, put your hands on your hips, like just 2 minutes, put your feet on the table, not when you're in the interview, mind you, but and then go in for your interview. And so they did this, and it was like a mock-up of interviewing people. And the people, I can't remember the details, but some of the people she got to judge those people, they said, we will hire that one, and that one, definitely not that or that or that. The people who had been powerful for 2 minutes got hired. And the people who were collapsed for 2 minutes didn't get hired. And it's all measurable, like quite huge proportions, quite interesting. So the answer is that it isn't just your mind that can change your mind. But if you, for instance, think of something you trust or someone you trust, then your body will relax, it will open up, your shoulders will come down, and that will affect more of how your mind is. Your mind affects your body, affects your mind, affects your body. The point I'm making. So we don't have to just think these things, we find that it comes alive in us. Okay, so that's the second one. When we're sinking in quicksand, or insecure, doubting, we need to notice what in our experience gives us a sense of firmness, solidity, reliability, that we can trust, place our hearts upon. A third one that again causes our systems to be agitated and distressed and not calm, as we all know this too very well, is a lot of criticizing and judging. We do that so much. We compare, we evaluate, we complain, we criticize, you know, and all versions of the relatives of all of that. We do it to ourselves a huge amount, we do it to other people under our breath, if not over our breath, or whatever the thing is. A lot. And it just is distressing. It's upsetting for whoever receives it, whether it's inward we're doing it or outward we're doing it, negativity, unkindness. We need the opposite. We need a lot of kindness and reassurance. We need a lot of positivity. We need a lot of being allowed to be who we are and accepted. We need a lot of loving kindness. And when we address ourselves or others from a place of kindness, acceptance, respect, even just simple respect, it calms us down. And when we get, you know, it's like praise and blame. When you get blamed and criticized, it's really upsetting. It's like somebody stabbed you, especially if they do it with some accuracy and some emotion. It's like, oh. And if they're close enough to you, it's just like attacking. It's really upsetting. And the opposite, being praised, being appreciated, being valued, you know, is unbelievably, it just soothes us right away. So kindness, friendliness, acceptance, encouragement, appreciation are incredibly effective ways of soothing that defended, anxious part of ourselves. And with friendliness, the word in Pali that's been used a lot for many of you heard for years, metta, was translated from long, long time as loving kindness. I actually don't use that word much anymore. I really like friendliness, because it's not so Hollywood-able. It's just like much more kind of ordinary and natural. But it's, when you're friendly with someone, you have space for that person. You care about that person. You know, you have empathy for the person you care about when you're friendly. You're sometimes really generous, sometimes you're really helpful, but sometimes you're just quiet when it's your friend. You're not going to judge them or fix them or only like them if they behave a certain way, and then if they don't behave that way, you don't like them. That's not friendly. It's very judgy. So I like to think of friendliness of having two kind of ways of expressing itself. One is by being kind and doing things and saying things and giving things and being generous and attentive and encouraging and all that, what I call active friendliness. But as important, or even more important, I seem to think, probably because it's neglected perhaps, is passive friendliness. And passive friendliness, what I simply mean is the kind of friendliness which doesn't jump in with an opinion, but just lets it be the way it is. The receptive, the one who's the good listener, the one who really is there to hear what's going on. The one who can let you be how you want to be, and if you have something to say, and if you have something to say that's not appropriate, who isn't going to rush in there and fix you, you know, who's simply there. That passive, it's a giving space. The giving part is making space for you to be the way you are, or it to be the way it is, instead of having an opinion right away, or wanting to make it a little bit better, which is often quite disrespectful. So friendliness in all the various ways, and there's so many ways we'll apply that, we'll practice some of that tomorrow also. The effect is the opposite of being, you know, either misseen or unseen or criticized or judged, which is as much we do for ourselves as for other people. It's hugely important. Wonderful practice, as we know, that connects us. All forms of generosity and interest. People being interested in you. Super healing thing just to be interested in somebody. You know. Tell me about yourself. How are you? That's a passive friendliness, but it's fantastic if somebody does that. So they say, oh, how are you? I'm fine. I've been doing this, 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 and this. Doesn't feel so great. Okay, so those are three things, very important. I think these are all seven very important. I won't go into them all in such depth because of time, but I could. The fourth one, and this isn't fourth by any importance, this is just, I've just numbered them. Number four in my list. When the Buddha talked about the teaching, the qualities of meditation and the unfolding of the path of practice and how it's onward leading towards increasing freedom, one of the teachings he gave was Bojanga. This is the seven factors of awakening. Who's familiar with this teaching? A few hands. So these are seven, and they aren't just as steps, but they also do work in terms of steps. Just brief, the first one is to be mindful. This is what we're practicing, meaning being present and knowing what's happening, that knowing part of the mind, that second mind, not just the part that's present, but the knower, the right hemisphere, in other words, mindfulness. We have to practice that. Then we practice the next step, which is being interested in whatever it is we're paying attention to, so that the attention will stay. That's, you know, calmness is necessary, but so that the attention will actually be able to extend and we can see much more penetratively and understand much more. So a degree of curiosity and fascination with what it is you're seeing, not in an analytical way and not in a way to evaluate, but simply just to help you stay there. And I always use Jane, for a long time I've been using Jane Goodall as an example, who went out with her notebook for all those years with the chimpanzees with no agenda. She wasn't trying to find out if they this or if they that or why they this or why. She just was watching them. She just was open, receptive, interested, available, and let the information come. But it was her interest that kept her being there. She was interested, but in a passive way. Interested not with trying to get something, but just interested. That's what we mean by the second factor of awakening, interest, dhammavicaya. It's often translated as investigation, and that's far too busy, I think. It's far too left hemispherish for me. The third one we also have to do, and that's learning how to apply our energy to keep doing it. It's the application of energy, and it's a skill to be able to be sufficiently engaged with enough oomph to keep doing it, but without so much that you get tired or that you get tight. And actually, how is sustainable energy? And I have another little story to tell about this. And I've, some of you will have heard me say this because I've been saying this recently for quite some time, but it's a great little story. Excuse the repetitions. You never know who hears these things or who downloads your talks and has heard it all before. But anyway, this one is a good one. When I was growing up in England in the 50s, we English had a famous, world-famous race car driver called Stirling Moss. Some of you will have heard of him, especially those with grayer hair. And so he was very famous, but he had a sister, and she was also a race car driver, and her name was Pat Moss. But she wasn't world famous, she was just Britain famous. But the racing she did wasn't Formula Run racetrack racing, it was rally driving on regular roads. And so they would, you know, put roads aside for the race. And she won a lot of races, but not just any old rally racing. The races she won were the races where she got there first, but having used the least amount of petrol. That's what virya means in meditation. It's like how to do what we do, really do it, but the most sustainably efficient way, so that you don't unnecessarily do anything and get tired in the process, but you really get there, kind of thing. So it's the Pat Moss of meditation is the third of these factors. And we have to do those, one, two, and three. They're applying ourselves. The fourth one happens. You can't make it happen and you can't do it exactly, but what happens as a result is you apply yourself, you're present, you're interested in your experience, and you learn how to apply yourself in this light sustaining way, sooner or later moments of delight start happening. It gets to be really neat. The translation I don't agree with, because it just again makes it Hollywood, but it's called a rapture. Well, rapture, who goes into raptures over things these days? Not that many, certainly not sitting there with your knees hurting in some, you know, moldy meditation center. So, but there's a sense of kind of enthusiastic delight. It's like, this is cool. We begin to get this joy, little bits of joy, and it's experienced in all different ways by different people, but there is a certain amount of this. What happens, which you can't make happen, you can't manufacture it, you can just do steps 1, 2, and 3. And but then there gets to be this joy. And what happens to the system when there's been some joy, even if it's little moments of it? Serenity. Calm. The next step in the 7 is calm, because of the joy. For years in my meditation practice, I do steps 1, 2, and 3 with great enthusiasm. Type A, strive on, you know, all that. And I just did it and did it, did it. And I was like, I'm not going to think thoughts. I'm not going to get distracted. I'm just going to stay with my breath. And eventually, through dint of willpower, I became quite quiet and quite calm. But it was really hard work. And then I learned and got a little wiser as time went by and began to trust the process more, and had a rather shocking teaching from a colleague who's a teacher, mentor, has become a colleague of mine, who said, of course, you know, the real secret to concentrating is relaxation. And I went, relaxation? You gotta be kidding me. I was just like, work, 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 you know. But I began to realize that you don't have to push it quite so hard. You know, I was Stirling Moss for sure, you know. I was like, you can just relax and trust the system. And then my own experience, some of you know this for sure, I've had a few beautiful moments. You know, I'd be doing something, I'd be walking, mostly it's walking in nature in England, in the countryside where I like to practice, in Devon with Gaia House, and seeing the light in the glinting in the leaves in the trees, or the fields covered with cobwebs. I've got some lovely stories I've told about that. And then after some experience or other that just brought so much joy, I then would go and sit, and I would be so . So with the teachings of the Buddha teaches the way to calm yourself is enjoy. Joy, piti, the word, leads to serenity, pasati. Piti leads to pasati, piti leads to pasati. And I thought, wow, that's a real shortcut. I just spent all these last 20 years like really getting really, really concentrated. And now it just happens, boop, I just have to go and see a few cobwebs, and I'm just like, And so, I mean, it isn't quite that easy, but it's much easier than just trying to make yourself get really still. When we fill ourselves up with something that's joyful, we just get so relaxed. Recently, I've rejoined a choir that I had joined a while ago. I have to spend the night off my island and go on a ferry and all, but the Getting Higher Choir in Victoria. And there's so much joy in singing with another 100 people, beautiful harmonies, that it's just so soothing. Anyway, there are different ways for all of us to find some degree of joy. And it's not just to be happy for the hell of being happy, because happiness is fun. I'm using these as tools to enable calm. And it actually really, really does calm. And calm for its own sake. It's lovely to be calm instead of agitated, absolutely. That too is a beautiful experience. But it's in service of freedom. It's in service to being able to meditate and be with all of everything, including the difficult and the embarrassing and the challenging and the sad and the worries and everything, and become free of this agitated, it's the separate sense of self that's all the agitation. We can become really freed, but we need this calm. So these are pieces, beautiful in their own right, but I'm teaching them in terms of tools. So here we've got to 4 of 7. How are we doing for time? Okay, I'm going to whiz through the next 3 just for them. I have to mention them. They're all good. Okay, another thing that causes our distress, our anxiety, is when we get really personal and we get really picky about detail. Oh, I'm so this, and how could this happen? And we get very narrow. And what really relaxes that is to, I call it zoom out. When you see the big picture, it's like you go from being the little kid to being the grandmother in the rocking chair. It's okay, dear, you'll get over it. It will pass. It's what happens when you're three and you fall over, but you'll be fine. You'll grow up to forget all about it. You know, the big view, the big perspective, you know, and here's the story that, again, I tell these stories, but this was a great story. My mother was a very, may she rest in peace, she was an agitated individual who got really very challenging for me. She was very critical, and suddenly out of the blue, some would come hurling my way, and it would, like a dagger, and she was coming for supper, and my son was 15 at the time. 16 actually, yes, 16. And I was anxious because she was very critical about anything, cobwebs and all kinds of things. And so I was all getting all in a fuss in the kitchen, and she'd be here any minute now. And I was fiddling around with the supper and worrying if it was all going to be okay. And my son, who is now not quite towering over me, but was now bigger than me, which he really liked when he finally got to be big enough, he came up beside me and he put his hands on my back in between my shoulder blades, sort of instinctive place for reassurance with his hand, and he whispered in my ear, he said, "Remember the stars, Mum." Wise young man, big picture. Okay, keep it all in proportion, don't sweat the small stuff, it's all small stuff. Anything at all that can help with that is calming. And when we get, oh my, this and oh, this is so awful, and there's another great story that's similar, is Eckhart Tolle tells it in his book, Be Here Now. That's Ram Dass's book, The Power of Now. Somebody came to see him with her troubles, and she, "I've got to talk to you." And he said, "Okay." And so she came in, and for 20 minutes, she's pouring out all of this, and my tenants do this, and the plumbing is that, and I don't know what the stuff was, but anyway, her troubles, whatever they were. And she's just like, and he's, from his point of view, he's writing the book. He's like, he didn't know what to say. He's no counselor, he's just an enlightened person. Anyway, so he's sitting there and she's like going on and on and on. It's kind of like she's pouring it out until she's calming herself down by, emptying out all of her woes on him. But he has nothing to say. And so after she sort of stopped talking for a while and she looked at him and he just is smiling benignly, and just there for her. And then she realizes that he isn't wound up at all about any of it. Like, he hasn't taken any of it on at all. And then she realizes, and she says, "It's not that important, is it?" And he says, "No, not really." And so she then says, "Thank you so much, you really helped me." And she, she praises him and all this. And he says, "I didn't really do anything, I just..." But by being with him, because he wasn't catching every little detail and making a little mountain out of every molehill, she realized that she had been, and she didn't need to. So these are just examples of zooming out, instead of the way we get to all zoom in and all the little details. So in whatever way we can turn our ring that says, "This too shall pass, this too shall pass," whatever it is for yourself, that's a super effective way of calming yourself. I said I'd whiz, I'm whizzing now. Okay, that was five. Number six. However you can do this, and this is tricky, so I won't go into it at depth. We'll do it tomorrow or on Sunday probably. when we get agitated and we get disturbed, what happens is we are caught up in the drama. We're entangled in, involved in, worried about, struggling with, needing to get, in some way, we're involved in whatever the situation is, right? Like she was with her stuff. And what we want to do, zoom out is one way. We want to disentangle. We want to be able to release, let go of all of that. It's easy to say that, it's not so easy to do that, but some people are able to say, just let it be. Now, let go itself is tricky because it's very easy to become, let's get rid of it. Let's let go of it so we don't have to have it. It's actually, let's get rid of it. And that's not disentangling, that's aversion. And we might distract ourselves, or we could easily blame or criticize it if it won't go away. But that's not what I mean by let go. Basically, it's let. Let this come if it's come, let it be here if it's here, let it go when it goes. Let go of my having to have it be other. Let go of my hunger. Let go of my resistance. Let go of my story. Let go of my meing around it. Let it just be, this is what's happening. As I said, it's complicated to do because we can honestly misunderstand what that means. But we're really trying to release the tendency to think about, talk about, worry about, get involved with the situation and just tolerate it. Can we just tolerate it even when it's unpleasant? So it's about allowing things to be as they are rather than feeling that we have to fix everything. This is not the same thing as doing nothing. This doesn't mean, oh, I'm just going to be a doormat forever and everything's going to become beige and I don't care and let the world go to hell in a handbasket and I don't care. It doesn't mean becoming numb. It means not acting out of reactivity that's triggered because we can't handle something and we're all tangled up. It means having some clarity, saying, oh, this is what's happening, and then making a choice, what would be helpful? And then we can act, but we can be proactive rather than reactive. It doesn't mean we're going to be non-active. But it means we're not going to be all caught up as best we can. That's more, takes more to talk about and to practice with, so I won't, it's too late now. The next one is, the last one I have, which I just think this is so important, so I have to just mention it, even though I'll just mention it, is that I said in the beginning, what tends to agitate us is our attraction for and belief in the importance and significance, really, of extremely pleasant and extremely unpleasant, and are not bothering with the range in between. Well, guess what? If you pay attention, give your attention to some of the more mediocre in between qualities of things, it's way more calming than going for the highs and the lows, which are so stimulating. And, you know, but we don't even think that's normal. We think that's boring. When you meet each other, you greet somebody, you haven't spoken to them for a little while. Hey, how are you doing? What's happening? Well, let me tell you all about the highs and the lows in my life. But we don't say, it was a nice day today. Sun came out for a while. Daffodils are heading up now. That's not significant enough to be newsworthy. And we think that it has to all be dramatic to be even discussed. Even to be noticed, even to think about. Well, if you instead place some attention into these simple things, the cobwebs, whether your mother's going to criticize you or whether they're shining with moonlight, simple things, you'll discover you can be aware and present without being triggered into this agitated high and low reactivity. It's not going to do it. It doesn't stimulate you the same way. It's just fascinating. And you discover, oh my goodness, life is so rich. There's so much that's so neat and sweet and exquisite that may not be newsworthy, may not be evoking huge emotional response, but actually it's evoking a lot of calm love, you know, and awe sometimes even, but in an ordinary kind of way. So don't underestimate the value of the neutral things that you normally would dismiss. If you want more calm, go watch a carrot grow for a while. Okay, there you go. That's enough, I think. One day I'm going to, I've been threatening this for years, you know, they say, I've never listened to him, but Castro used to be able to give a talk for like 4.5 hours. I'd like to compete, because I have to stop myself. I could just go on and on, right? It's already late, and I've been talking for quite a while. I want to kind of wait for one of those full moon nights and just keep talking and talking about the Dharma and see how long I can do it, because I have to stop myself. Anyway, so I'm stopping now. But I really would appreciate your comments or any kind of feedback or any kind of questions or any sharing that you'd like around this topic for a few minutes. It's 9:15, not quite, so we've got, you know, 10 minutes maybe. Hi, give me your name.
I'm Harlan.
Harlan? Yeah. Hi.
Something that I find kind of oddly distressing is that I get songs stuck in my head.
Oh, yes. Songs.
Do you have any strategies?
Well, the only Harlan's saying one of the things that distresses him, that irritating, is you get a song stuck in your head. It's extraordinary, especially when you do retreat. More so, because there's less other things to distract you, and it just goes on and on. I was on retreat once with Joan Byers, And it was a 10-day retreat. And I didn't know it was Joan Baez until she was opposite me in the serving line. And it was Joan Baez. But the last time I'd seen her was like 30 years ago, you know, and she was young and beautiful. Anyway, I spent the next 2 days perfecting every word of Diamonds and Rust, which is like 12 verses. And then it was completely in my head for like the rest of the retreat. I totally understand it. That happens to be a lovely song, but it was too much. No. Anyway, so two things I would say, Harlan. I would say tolerate it and let it be in the back burner and do what you can do to place your attention to something else. So if it's ears, because it's going on and on and on, you have to think of it as having a neighbor with their radio station on the back, and you just have to tune them out. Mothers have to do this with little children, well, fathers too, if you have little kids. There's a time when you just can't take it all in, it's too much. And so what you do is replace your attention elsewhere. So whether that is open your eyes and look outside, or go into the body and feel the rest of your body, not somewhere up here, but go down and feel a breath in the belly, or something like that, so that you're not giving it so much attention, and then it's less. It's still there, but it's less. So it just reduces in impact because you're not giving it that juice. That's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do would be, I would look at, if it persists, which of course that's the problem with it, is I would look at what it's like to be so agitated. And rather than use it to pay attention because it's triggering agitation, is I'd look at what's it like being so agitated. And I would explore the churny feeling, the tension, the jaw gripping, the going on, and see that actually what's happening is there's a song in your head. That's one thing. That's called one dart. And then you're adding a whole lot of on top of it. You're turning a smallish thing into, you're making a mountain out of a molehill because of your dislike of it. And that's yours. You can't do anything with the sound. It's in there. It's just the way it is. It will fade away sooner or later. It always does. But in the meantime, you can either get in there and struggle and make it into a monster, or not. And so how you not is to realize that you are, and that in doing that, it's really costly. Is tension and this irritation here, or your teeth are grinding, or whatever it is you're doing, you're frowning, or whatever you're doing, and you're going around like pig pen, you know, and you're actually choosing that you can do something about. You can't do anything about the first dart, but the Buddha said the trouble with us isn't the first dart, the trouble is the second dart, that we then add to that. And so notice that they're two separate things. You cannot do usually anything about this one, but you can do everything about this one. And it's not usually this one, it's usually 100. You know, it isn't just like one other dart. You know, there's a sound, but it's like now it's like 5 hours of frustration and oh, what if this and oh, how could this be and why isn't it Mozart? That has to be in my head, some stupid blah, blah, blah. Like we add. And you're actually doing that to yourself. And the third piece always to say is don't take it personally. It's not that you're doing anything wrong. It's just that's what we do. Your little left hemisphere is trying to help you by getting mad at this thing, thinking it'll get rid of it somehow, but all it does is make it worse. So thank you, left hemisphere, but you know, why don't you go home, and I'm gonna do a little right hemisphere thing of breathe and be with my feet. Take it, you know, make a joke out of it or something. Good luck. Hi.
Ryan.
Hi, Ryan.
I was wondering if you had any suggestions for using mindfulness to cope with heartache.
Heartache. Yeah. Heartache. Yes, I do. I'm familiar. usually, when there's anything that's unpleasant, and that's one of the most unpleasant ones we have emotionally, usually, whatever the unpleasant thing is, the survival mode, the way we go through life with our little busy left hemisphere trying to help us be okay, is to, similarly actually to just what I was saying here with Harlan, is to add the darts of aversion to it. oh no, this is awful, oh this is wrong, oh this is going to be awful, I'm never going to get over this, how could this happen, what did I do, could I have done something differently, la 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 la. We build it with all this thinking. The thinking that we're doing is intended to help, but the actual fact is it grows it, it doesn't help it. Because there's no answer to any of those questions or those feelings. It just is like we're rolling in it. It's actually in, it's called papancha. It's like proliferating around the feeling. There's two things there. There's the feeling, which is painful and really unpleasant and hurt usually. Hurt and loss combined and shame maybe even and things. And that's emotional and it feels, you know, painful, painful. But then there's the thinking that then is stimulated by the feeling. And the reason that we think around it, on and on, all those things, is because we believe somehow part of us that thinking will help. We've given this thinking thing huge power. When it doesn't help, it just exaggerates it, and it just while you're wallowing in it, and on, round you go, thrashing around. And so, this is takes guts to do, but what you want to do is not unlike what I said to Harlan, is actually feel how sad you feel. And let yourself feel it. We are afraid that if we go towards painful or unpleasant circumstances that we won't be able to handle it. This is our survival wiring. And survival wiring is very primitive, like it's super primitive. It's not intelligent. It's deer in front of the headlights fear. It's like, stupefying, I call it. It's stupefying. And so fear doesn't let us even get anywhere close to an intelligent response here. It just is like, oh, this is awful. I cannot stand this feeling. It's a horrible, horrible sinking, loss, grief, terrible feeling. And so our little mind goes, okay, let's not think it. Let's try and get rid of it. Maybe you shouldn't have done this. And if you'd done something else, or maybe she'll come back again, or maybe he will forgive you, or whatever it is. All of that trying to help you, but not helping you. So instead, say to this little busy mind, I'm just going to feel sad. And let yourself feel it, and you'll discover it's not so scary. You're not going to die. You don't die. It's just sad and it's horrible, but you can do that. And then if you can tolerate staying there, it takes gumption, but if you can stay with that feeling, again, like I said to Ryan, to Harlan, feel, what is it? Where is it? Is it in here? Is it in here? Is it in your guts? Where are you feeling what you're feeling? What's it like to feel that feeling? Just let yourself feel it. And you'll discover that the feeling itself is manageable. It's tolerable. It's just unpleasant. You don't have to go through all of that other justification and wonder, and just let yourself feel what it is for a while, a little while, and then do something else, like I said to him. Okay, let me do something else. I'm going to count a few blessings here. Think of some of the things that do give me a sense of trust that I know is good in my life. So I'm not just doing that. And then it'll come again, and then feel it again. And little by little, you discover that it's tolerable. And what I mean by that is, I love this image, it's a great image. The unpleasant, whatever it is, in your case, heartbreak, is like lying under a boulder. If you can be with that feeling, honestly, and just that feeling, it starts to become gravel. It doesn't become bubbles and feathers and things. It becomes still hard and still heavy. But it's not one big solid cement mass, I'm brokenhearted and this is the end of the world. It's like, this moment is really sad. This moment I'm bored. This moment I'm hungry. This moment I'm grateful for. This moment I'm really sad. This moment I'm really hurt. This moment I need to pee. This moment I'm bored. This moment, you know, and you'll discover it's gravel. It's different moments, some of which are really undigestible. Gravel's not digestible. It's not like chocolate. But it's not a boulder that's going to smash you. That's the first thing. And the second thing, without a doubt, that we need with anything that's difficult, anything, a lot of kindness. Of course you feel like that. They write songs about it. It makes all movies, all poetry, it makes the world go round. Love and loss, love and loss. It's like, welcome to the reality of the world. It's like, not just you. This is what it's about. And it's if you never loved, you'd never have that feeling. They go together. You know, it's the richness of life, and everyone knows it, and we've all been here. I would bet there's not one hand in here that would say they've never had a broken heart. And, you know, it's what happens when you love. We're vulnerable, and we're going to lose it somehow or other. And just bring some kindness to yourself for that. Like, it's a hard time. It's a sad thing. But it's sort of sweet, because it means you really care. You know, it means you've actually been really open and you've been really close. It's part of the deal. Praise and blame, you know, loss and gain, pleasure and pain. It's inevitable. It's normal. It's how it is. It's okay. You'll keep going. You'll learn a lot. That's what I would do, that kind of talk. Kindness and just not get into the thinking about it, because that's trying to help and it's making it worse. Okay. Anything else? Anyone else, please? Was that talk useful?
Yes.
Yeah? It's not news, but it's effective. Okay. Okay.